from New York City, this is Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit. I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore. Coming up on this week's show, our picks for what's worth watching in the world of streaming and on-demand movies.
Later in our Listener's Choice review, it's a Fjord Fiesta as Allison and I review Netflix's first original series, Lilyhammer.
But first, we'll offer up our listings of new, notable, and expiring titles on Netflix Watch Instantly and other streaming and VOD services. This is Q Shots.
That's right, and we try to start every week here on the show in Q Shots with a sort of a pairing. We each try to find a title or a couple of titles that go together quite nicely in some way, and this week we're going to be talking about Roger Corman Productions. It just so happens that a whole bunch of films from Roger Corman's New World production company from the 1970s all went up on Netflix, so we figured why not talk about a couple of them. We each picked one of our favorites, and we're going to talk about them to start the show. My favorite, my pick, which is available on Netflix Watch Instantly, is entitled Death Race 2000.
The year 2000. America is a vast speedway. People line the streets to witness the greatest drivers on Earth in a race from sea to shining sea.
This is a death race.
You finish first, or not at all. Death Race 2000. Every car a deadly weapon. Every spectator a potential point. It's a cross-country road wreck, and the traffic is murder.
Not from the year 2000, but from the year 1975 and directed by Paul Bartel. Allison, have you ever seen Death Race 2000?
I have not, though I did see the remake.
Oh, you saw the remake. Okay, yes, it was remade in 2008. The remake version was a lot less fun, it was a lot less political, it was a lot less smart, and a lot more boring. And as perhaps the biggest Jason Statham fan on the planet,
I was waiting for this.
Basically the biggest Jason Statham fan on the planet who's not Jason Statham's mother, I take no pleasure in saying that the remake of Death Race was not fantastic, but it is the truth. The original Death Race 2000, set in the year, 2000, right? It's about the transcontinental road race, which is sort of one part NASCAR, one part Gladiator, one part reality television. And given the fact that reality television was about 25 years away when they made this film, that lends a certain amount of prescience. Not a huge amount of prescience, but enough to make it interesting. The car action is really fun. All the drivers have these crazy cars, these customized cars. The acting is great from actors like Sylvester Stallone in one of his very earliest roles playing Machine Gun Joe Viterbo. and David Carradine as the main character Frankenstein, the Statham role in the sequel, wearing this all-leather getup with a cape and a hideous face mask and a weird Darth Vader helmet. It's just a hoot. You know, it has a little bit of political intelligence to it, the fact that it is sort of anticipating reality television and our shared sort of interest in bloodlust. And it has some really great car chase sequences, and it has some really fun acting. It's just what you want from an exploitation film like a Roger Corman production. It's dumb, but it's not too dumb. It's got a little bit of smarts in it, but it also manages to balance the dumb action and the smart commentary. It never preaches. It just sort of melds the two together in a really nice way. So Death Race 2000, it's on Netflix Watch Instantly. What's your Roger Corman production, Allison?
My pick is 1980's Battle Beyond the Stars, directed by Jimmy T. Murakami. It's a remake of the Seven Samurai / The Magnificent Seven set in space.
Ruthless invaders, a defenseless planet, battle beyond the stars.
And the screenplay, the talent actually involved in this is pretty amazing, considering the screenplay was written by John Sayles, the score was composed by James Horner, and the special effects were managed by a young James Cameron.
And Jimmy Cameron, as we knew him back
exactly.
then.
And this is actually, it was the priciest Corman production at the time, cost an estimated $2 million. Though, of course, they made the most of this by recycling some of the footage and some of the props later on in other films.
It was his answer. It was him being Corman. It was Corman's answer to Star Wars, wasn't it? It was, you know,
definitely.
Star Wars comes out, Corman, that's his world. How is he going to compete? He's going to have to make his own, and this is what he made.
Yeah, and I would say that it's probably not quite up to Star Wars. I don't
probably
think anyone
not.
Would argue that.
No.
It does have an interesting cast, including Richard Thomas as the main character, who you may know as John Boy Walton. It's got John Saxon as the villain, Sador, who I always think of as Roper from Enter the Dragon. You've got Robert Vaughn and George Peppard as two of the samurai, basically, who are all, like, they have their own spaceships and they're all gathered to help defend the peaceful farm planet of Akir, named for Akira Kurosawa. And you have these really ridiculous aliens, including a collective group of five all white people who are one consciousness. You have these aliens that communicate via heat. I do have to say, even though some of the costuming looks really funny, there's a lot of like polyester looking things. Not everything looks great. A lot of it looks cheap. The models actually do look really good. The spaceship models hold up really well, mm-hmm. which I think is partially a testament to Cameron's skill. He obviously, it worked out well for him. That kid had talent. but I think it's also a side effect of physical effects, that they do tend to hold up better than computer effects do, which age faster.
Interesting. So yes. You're saying if Roger Corman made a digital production of Battle Beyond the Stars, at that time it wouldn't look as good, you think?
I think it would probably look terrible. I mean, if you look at even digital effects from 10 years ago, they look older, noticeable. But anyway.
Not to get off on too much of a tangent.
Yes.
But those analog effects, they were pretty much the apex of analog effects, or pretty
right.
close to the apex, whereas the digital effects of 10 years ago were the earliest digital effects.
Yes.
So perhaps maybe that's an unfair comparison.
Oh, well, I think that I'm perfectly willing to accept that digital effects, 20 years from now will look maybe immaculate and that
right.
there'll be no way to tell. But
right.
I think at the time when we're still, in the process of improving this, the whole idea of digital effects, that there you can obviously tell a few years later, if not because of quality, often also because of just like trends in what a monster looked like at that mm-hmm. time, So I do think that some of the space effects in this held up really well, if there are a lot of ridiculous other things in it. So that's Battle Beyond the Stars. That is available on Netflix Watch Instantly until August 1st.
All right, my next cue shot is in the category of movies for your double feature with Lilyhammer. In case Lilyhammer whets your appetite for more Norwegian culture, here is some additional Norwegian culture for you, and it is called Norwegian Ninja. It's from the year 2010. It's directed by Thomas Capellan Malling. Probably it's the action movie version of Zelig. That makes any sense. It's about a real figure from Norwegian history who I didn't know anything about, but I'm sure Norwegians do, who was accused, arrested, tried of being a Soviet spy. And the movie creates this sort of alternate history where this guy wasn't actually a spy, but was in fact a ninja, a secret agent ninja for the Norwegian government, who was like blackmailed and left out to dry by his handlers and what have you. As a fall guy, basically.
Overvåkningspolitiet har pågrepet Arne Treholt og siktet han for ulovlig etterretningsverksemd til fordel for ei fremmed makt.
Noen måtte jo snakke med russerne for å finne ut hva som foregår.
Du vet jeg glad I Arne.
Ninja-troppen Kong Olavs enhet for usynlig krigføring som beskytter de norske livslovene.
Arne.
It's a very, very strange movie. I don't think all of the jokes work because I don't understand a lot of the jokes. I think a lot of it is very Norwegian specific. If you know this person's story, I bet it's funny. I bet if you know the references that these people are making, it's probably even funnier. But there is something about the aesthetic of the movie that I really admire. It has a very Michel Gondry feel, has a very hands-on, tactile feel, very analog, to bring it back to our Battle Beyond the Stars discussion. If there's digital effects in here, they don't look very digital, and there aren't a lot of them. And it just has kind of a really fun vibe. I mean, it's so absurd, this idea of this secret agent ninja, this really white guy with these big glasses. He wears these big 70s glasses in a ninja outfit, using the ninja techniques of like dropping a smoke bomb and vanishing in the middle of a conversation or something like that. It has this really fun sense of humor, has some really clever dialogue lines like, if God wanted us to be vegetarians, all vegetables would be made of meat, which I think he has a point. And I just sort of, I liked its attitude, I liked its spirit, I liked the look of it. Even if I didn't love everything about the plot, or I didn't understand everything about the plot, I enjoyed watching it. It's only about 80 minutes, and it's a great movie to watch on Netflix Instant, because you really get to appreciate the visuals, but you don't feel like you've spent a lot of money on it, wasted too much time on it. So that's Norwegian Ninja, and that is also on Netflix Instant.
I haven't seen that movie, and I'm actually really interested in seeing it. I think it played at Fantastic Fest.
It played at Fantastic Fest in 2010, I want to say, and I didn't see it there.
But I remember people like, talking about
it. It might have won an award or two. It got very positive response there, and I saw it just pop up on Netflix Instant, and I actually was like, oh, more Norwegian culture. I'm interested in soaking it up right now. Let's take a look, and I enjoyed it.
Excellent. I'm going to call this category the no matter how endless your dinner party can feel, it could be worse. And my pick is The Exterminating Angel, 1962, directed by Louis Buñuel, whose 112th birthday was actually on February 22nd.
Happy birthday, yes, of Louis Buñuel.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The Exterminating Angel was one of the films he shot in Mexico. And you surely heard of the premise, even if you've never actually seen the film yet. It's set at a formal dinner party, during which all the servants inexplicably leave. They all seem to feel this very strong urge to, like, they have to get out of the house, but they never seem to explain why. So all these guests arrive in formal wear, and there's only really one or two people around to serve them. And they sit down to a dinner, and it's, you know, and then it finishes, and they hang around and play the piano and drink. And then it becomes nighttime, and they all go to sleep in the room. And the hosts are starting to notice this is a little strange, but they're also not really sure what to do. And they start to realize that for no reason that's ever given, they're trapped. They're trapped at this dinner party, all in their formal wear still. They don't know how to leave.
Vuelva a llevarlo al jardín.
La señora me tranquiliza con esa medida, porque hay asuntos graves que requieren la inmediata atención de la señora.
¿Ocurre algo?
Suceden cosas muy extrañas.
And this scenario is played out in ways that are both like very funny and also just a little disturbing. And it's an interesting opposition to Buñuel's film, The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie, in which everyone keeps trying to eat dinner and is foiled. In this case, you can't leave your dinner party, though they do run out of food and have to forage in this really fancy salon. So it's, I think, you know, people take it as a satire about the kind of ruling class. You can take it as a lot of things, I think, or a descent into kind of society hell. But it's also just got a lot of really amazing, just surreal touches from things like the casual reveal that inside the nice purse of one of the women as she's like digging out for her compact or something is also a dead bird, you know, and small touches like that are just unforgettable and things that he always did so well. So this is actually for free on Hulu, courtesy of the Criterion Collection. For whatever reason, as I was watching this, because it's in Spanish, I suppose, the ads that are pulled up on Hulu are all Spanish ads. So,
interesting.
Yes, they'll pull up like a Spanish Pantene commercial starring Eva Mendes.
Hmm.
So that's The Exterminating Angel, and that's for free on Hulu.
That's a classic. I think Buñuel would have liked Norwegian Ninja, too. I think it has just the right touch of absurdity for him. All right, my last pick is to make a very brief double feature with Hugo, which, as we're recording this, is still a Best Picture nominee. By the time you're listening to this, you will know whether it is a Best Picture winner or a Best Picture also-ran. And it is the film, the very short film, Excelsior, Prince of Magicians from 1901, directed by and starring one Georges Méliès. This is an original Méliès short. It's available on Mubi for free. If you just log in with your Facebook account on Mubi, you can watch this short film for free. Orson Welles famously said of the Hollywood backlight, it was the biggest train set a boy ever had. I feel like for Méliès, it was the best magician's assistant he ever had. And I think this is if you saw Hugo and you enjoyed it and you liked learning about Méliès there and you weren't familiar with his story before Hugo, I think you'll really enjoy getting to see the real thing, the real deal in action in this very brief short film. This, you know, plotless. It's a classic two-minute short silent film just about magic. It's just a series of magic tricks all done with the magic of the movie camera. In terms of effects, holding up, which is something we've talked about a few times in this segment, they hold up pretty well, I have to say, given the incredibly crude technique that they were working with and the incredibly lo-fi technology they had in 1901. It looks pretty good as Méliès, I guess, as Excelsior, does some very strange things, including making a woman appear and then making her transform into two little girls, one sitting on top of the other's shoulders. Very surreal and strange.
Do you think that there's a kind of charm to these analog effects that digital effects might not be able to equal, just in terms of, like, even if you see through it a bit, it still has a kind of innovation that you can appreciate?
Yeah, well, in this case, there certainly is, because we're talking about a movie that is over 100 years old, mm-hmm. and you can still watch it. And granted, you have to suspend your disbelief a little bit harder than you would to, say, watch Transformers Dark of the Moon. But there, the fact that it holds it up as well as it does, I think, does lend it a certain charm to the analog effects. This is a conversation for, like, our old podcast, I think, you mm-hmm. know, of analog versus digital. And we could probably talk about it for another hour, perhaps. But there is something about analog that means it's realer to me, mm-hmm. right? Because they really had to do these things. Whether or not, you know, it's fake still in some ways, but when we see a guy spitting water out of his mouth, as we do in Prince of Magicians, like he's got a faucet stuck behind him, they had to figure out some way to actually do it.
Right.
There was no painted in water. They had to stick a hose behind the guy. Who knows how they did it? But mm-hmm. There was real water on that set, you know? So there is a certain amount of charm to that, I will say. And again, it's very short. 2 minutes long, but I think it's a lot of fun to see, and I think right now, you know, while we're all talking about Hugo, it's definitely worth seeking out Excelsior, Prince of Magicians, which is available for free on Mubi.
All right, my last pick, as a pairing for my other category, I'm going to call this, no matter how troubled your relationship with your mother can feel, it could be worse.
All of your things have to do with, like, relationship issues.
Yeah, I don't know
it's
why.
It's come up a lot already on the show.
Yeah, apparently. It's just expanded beyond, like, romance in this one to just social life and and family now.
Okay.
So I apologize to everyone I know. Anyway, the film is I'm Glad My Mother Is Alive, a 2009 French film directed by Claude and Nathan Miller. And it's a really interesting setup in that it starts with two neglected, like just a terrible act of neglect from a single mother who, like, leaves her two children, and they're taken away from her and given up for adoption. And we cut to the elder being kind of a surly teenager, you know, and the younger child is too young to really hold on to that past life. And he's kind of settled into this more comfortable, like, middle-class life and been given a new name even. But the older brother is haunted by this memory of his mother and of the where he was taken from. And as a young man, seeks her out. And their relationship parallels, not in, like, a Freudian sense necessarily, but like a romantic relationship, in that he approaches her with flowers and kind of becomes, she has a new son who she's also kind of neglecting, and they form a kind of odd family temporarily, though he's not really seeking to patch things up with her. He half hates her, but also just, you know, really wanted to reconnect with her.
Elle était comment, ma mère? Elle était belle?
Mais j'en sais rien, moi. Elle a jamais voulu nous rencontrer.
Moi, je m'en souviens. Elle était super belle.
Bah alors, pourquoi tu demandes?
Un jour, je viendrai vous chercher.
Oui.
Qu'est-ce que tu cherches? Nous pourrir la vie?
Tu vas t'arrêter, nom de Dieu! Tu vas t'arrêter, ouais!
Je suis Thomas. Votre fils, Thomas.
So it's a really emotionally complicated film, and it has a few great performances. I think it gets a little melodramatic towards the end, but I think it's still also worth seeking out. So that's on Netflix Watch Instantly. It's going to be there for about a year. It's I'm Glad My Mother Is Alive.
All right, now's the time on SVU when we tell you what films are going to be expiring in the near future that you're going to want to check out before they disappear. This is what we call Behind the Eight Ball. Allison, you're going to go first. What's your first expiring movie?
All right, this one expires on March 1st, so very soon. I also haven't seen this movie, so I'm looking forward to checking it out before that. It's The Deadpool, the fifth and final Dirty Harry movie featuring Clint Eastwood, also featuring Liam Neeson, Patricia Clarkson, and Jim Carrey. So, and then on March 7th, Videocracy is expiring, and this is a surreal and dark and very just like unforgettable documentary about Italy under Berlusconi. It's got some really crazy imagery, definitely worth seeing. And then on March 10th, Barcelona, which I would say is lesser Witt Stillman, which is still a very good movie. Chris Eigmann, Mira Sorvino, and kind of signature Witt Stillman dialogue.
Okay, my three selections start on March 15th when Escape from New York is expiring, the classic John Carpenter action sci-fi movie. And you're going to want to see this one before it expires because next month, right around when it expires, comes out Lockout, starring Guy Pearce, which looks essentially like Escape from New York in space. I mean, it literally looks like they just changed the names of the characters, changed the location from New York to space.
And to said, space jail.
Space jail. I know you keep calling it space jail. It is. It's basically Escape from Space Jail. That's right. So you're going to want to see the original, which is a fabulous movie, before that one expires. Also on March 15th, several Jean-Pierre Melville crime films are expiring, including Le Cercle Rouge and Bob Le Flambeur.
That's good.
I'm not very good at French. It's not one of my specialties.
No one's good at French.
No. Well, I think the French are. So these are, of course, classic crime slash heist movies. Required viewing if you're a fan of those genres. And expiring very soon on Netflix. And finally, also expiring from Netflix on March 17th, this is the MST3K collection Gamera. All of the MST3K movies where they watch Gamera. Gamera versus all the different creatures that Gamera fought. Some of my favorite episodes. There's some really great episodes in the Gamera collection. So if you're a fan of MST3K and you haven't seen the Gamera episodes, better watch them before they disappear. All right, so recapping Behind the Eight Ball here, we've got Escape from New York, Le Cercle Rouge, Bob and MST3K's Gamera collection. Those were my picks.
And my picks were The Deadpool, Videocracy, and Barcelona.
I'm going to give you the sucker. I got some demands. I'm thinking Lilyhammer.
You give us Aldo De Lucci, and we'll send you to the goddamn North Pole. Why the f*** do you want to go there?
Didn't you see the Olympics in 94? Clean air, fresh white snow, gorgeous broads. It was beautiful.
You must be the new neighbor.
Giovanni Hankrinson. Oh, you're in the postal service.
I'm chief of police.
Okay. You got me living in the projects next to the chief of police.
Driving a sewing machine. I gave you
Aldo f***ing Delucci.
Lon Chaney Sr. was famously known as the man of a thousand faces. Today, I would like to propose that we name Stephen Van Zandt the man of one faces. No matter the situation, the character, the line reading, Van Zandt has exactly one expression for it, which I would describe as the sour lemon. His head tipped menacingly forward, his eyes cold and stern, his lips pursed into a ferocious underbite. If you've seen Van Zandt as consigliere Silvio Dante on The Sopranos, if you've ever seen him in concert with Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band, I think you know what I'm talking about. It is interesting that Netflix decided to make that face the face of their new initiative into producing their own original content. Netflix has become an entertainment industry powerhouse by believing in an audience for streaming entertainment on the internet, and now that they've proven themselves correct, media companies who license their properties to Netflix for peanuts are realizing that there were gold in them thar on-demand hills. And it was inevitable then that Netflix would start to create their own original series that they could own in perpetuity and use to burnish their own library of streaming titles. They made a splash last year by announcing they were producing a series by David Fincher and Kevin Spacey called House of Cards. But before we get a look at that series, they're testing things out with Lilyhammer, which stars and is co-produced and co-written by Stephen Van Zandt, the legendary man of one faces. Van Zandt plays Frank the Fixer Tagliano, a mobster who looks, talks, dresses, and acts like Silvio Dante, who turns state's evidence and chooses to spend his witness protection in Lilyhammer, Norway, the famous home of the 1994 Winter Olympics. There, he tries to start up a new business, encounters the strange locals, falls for his attractive teacher, and arouses the suspicions of the local police. Allison, if folks listening haven't heard yet, you were recently hired by IndieWire as their new TV editor. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And when you get things up and running over there, you'll be covering lots of television shows. So here's Lilyhammer, Netflix's first original quote-unquote TV series. So my question is it worthy of the quality of television shows currently being produced on television? And would you deem this series worthy of future coverage on your soon-to-launch IndieWire TV site?
I think that production-wise, it looks about up to par with a lot of the series that you see crop up on Hulu these days. Not maybe a main network show, but certainly like a cable show or an international show.
Yep.
And which brings me to the point that it's important to note when watching this, that this is a Norwegian-American co-production, that it was also produced for Norwegian television, where apparently it premiered to an audience that equaled 1/5 of Norway's population. It was a big success, but that
Steven
this is
Van
not
Zandt, huge in Norway.
Huge, apparently. So this is not a pure Netflix production. They, you know, I'm assuming put up some of the
it.
Money.
Yeah.
And then, but it was also, so it's serving a few masters here. And I think that it does feel like that, which is part of the problem with the show and why it's not a show that I would imagine I would cover on in any great detail in terms of just because like editorially, I don't think it's that interesting. It's a fish out of water tale in which you have a gangster, like a very like iconic gangster in that way. You mentioned the single face that Van Zandt's capable of making. And then he does occasionally kind of lift his lip a little to sneer or indicate like acknowledgement of something and then kind of tilt his head. But and he also has his like shoulders up and he's got the coat draped over him. He the show is based off of the main joke of putting that face into the middle of like Norway and having him wear you know, a sweater with reindeer on it or something.
Right.
And that being like
big
hilarious.
Big ski coats. Yeah.
Yeah. And being like innately hilarious. But I don't think that there's much to the series. My question for you, Matt, is how did you feel about the fact that it basically, it finds something kind of positive in all of the gangsterisms and violence that he brings with him, like that is not inherent, like native to the community.
Yeah, it's very strange because his character is kind of unrepentant and at times really mean, but he's kind of the hero of the series. And I think that is one of the problems with the story is, I mean, he really is playing Silvio from The Sopranos. I mean, there's no difference. I mean, you could basically call this an unofficial spinoff. As unofficial spinoffs go, it's not exactly the Jeffersons from All in the Family or, dare we say, Film Spotting SVU from Film Spotting, but it's not aftermath. It's not terrible. You know, there. I have to say there are moments that I did laugh, and I think that's the moments where the show is at its best is when he's playing as comic relief, you know, and that's really what one of the things he was best at on The Sopranos was he was that guy who was kind of sitting in the corner who would often say something very dry and droll, and it would play off of James Gandolfini in a really funny way. The problem here is there is no James Gandolfini. He's the comic relief and also the, dare I say, romantic hero in the center of this. So I just wonder how long they can sustain this because, I mean, there's not a lot of narrative momentum. It's just sort of, you know, as I described, he goes to Norway and he just kind of waits around. And we didn't watch the whole first season, which is 8 episodes. We just watched the first couple of episodes. And I didn't really feel a strong need to keep watching. It wasn't like, I got to find out what happens. It seems the way they establish it after a few episodes, it seems like this is going to be his life in perpetuity. There doesn't seem to be a lot of narrative drive. There isn't a lot of danger or suspense or stakes involved with his life in Norway.
Yeah, there's the threat of him being discovered as a gangster, but then even that, you kind of wonder what is going to happen, like in that, like what could possibly really go wrong. The show sets up a lot of humor that I think is probably more intended for Norwegian audiences in that he runs into bureaucracy, like, you know, he runs into having to register with like the job, you know, the job help database and to go to a class to help him blend in as an immigrant and learn about Norwegian culture, or that he tries to hire sexy waitresses for his club and they're like, this goes against union rules. Like it gets a lot of humor from what I would imagine are things that are more resonant to a Norwegian audience who's like, yes, that's what we do. And isn't it funny that he doesn't understand, like, you know, he's outraged by this or thinks it's, you know, ridiculous.
On the other hand, there are some funny culture clash moments, like when he wakes up one morning and there's a dead, there's like a sheep's head on his doorstep and we're all thinking, oh, it's the Godfather. Oh, someone's sending him a message. But no, it's somebody's dinner that they accidentally dropped out of their bag.
Right. You know? And I did like when he to threaten someone, he and his like lackey put him down a ski jump. Like they put him on skis and like dump him down a ski jump. Which I thought was a pretty amusing answer to how you would, you know, threaten someone in a Jersey sense. But it is pretty slim so far. There's not a lot of forward momentum, as you say. And unfortunately, I think when you have a show that's kind of based very character driven in that sense, that you need a pretty charismatic lead. And, you know, to your point, Matt, I think that Vincent is better as a sidekick than he is as someone who has to carry a whole show.
Right. And it doesn't help that the side characters, and it's a fairly large ensemble, it doesn't help that those side characters aren't particularly memorable, at least not yet. The guy who works at the unemployment office begins to develop as sort of a villain of types, or at least an antagonist for his character. And I kind of like some of the scenes that they have together, the push and pull that they bring to one another. But a lot of the other characters all kind of fade together. There's a bunch of characters who either work at the bar that he ends up opening or are friends with the guy who owns the bar that he ends up opening. And they all kind of, they're not very distinctive. They're not different enough. They're all just like a bunch of guys who are hanging around and saying goofy, weird, you know, Norwegian things. Here was one thing that I didn't quite understand, Allison. I'm wondering if this bothered you too. In the first episode, he moves to Lillehammer and he's listening to his headphones and he is studying Norwegian. And in the first episode, he has some scenes where he's trying to explain himself. He doesn't quite understand. By episode two, he seems to understand Norwegian perfectly. And he never speaks in Norwegian, or almost never speaks in Norwegian. He only speaks in his accented English. And everyone understands him. And it just seemed very convenient to me that everyone is speaking Norwegian except Steven Van Zandt, who's speaking English, but they both seem to understand each other perfectly. Did that bother you?
Odd. It's an odd solution to what was obviously the problem of him not speaking Norwegian and unlikely to learn much more than a few phrases.
Yeah.
And the cast and the desire to have the show be not primarily in English, I think, to probably split it 50-50. I mean, that's one of the many leaps you have to make in addition to believing that the Witness Protection Program can extend to moving you to Norway, in addition to, I don't know, a lot of things. But it is a little awkward. The whole time it feels a little awkward. You know, we mentioned the violence before, and I do want to reiterate that it's a little weird how this show actually does the opposite of what The Sopranos ended up doing, which is that in The Sopranos, you think that you're going to have a character who's kind of like a lovable anti-hero, and he actually becomes more and more toxic in terms of Tony Soprano.
Right.
And then in this case, you have a character who really is supposed to be a lovable anti-hero. Like, even though he does things like, he encourages a young boy to basically fight back at school, even though this ends with the kid possibly getting expelled, to fight back against bullies. There is a Muslim man who is in his class who refuses to shake the hand of his love interest because he says it's forbidden, right?
That, like, it's against his religion.
It's against his religion. And
he intimidates the guy into violating his religion.
Exactly. And it's presented.
It's presented as comedy.
As comedy, or kind of heroic almost, to be like, yeah, well, now you're in Norway and this is how you behave. You shake her hand.
It is a very odd. Yeah, it's a very odd way of characterizing him, because you're right. His bullying is treated as endearing or comical, whereas it is bullying. That's really what it amounts to. And it's a strange way to look at that character.
He kills a wolf in the first episode, and it's presented as a kind of heroic act as well.
Right.
It's illegal. Like, you're not allowed to hunt wild animals in Norway, so they have to surreptitiously figure out how to kill this wolf, which killed a boy sheep. And it is weird. It's weird to be presented as this act of kind of cutting through all of this, you know, pacifism or so on.
Seems to be some kind of comment on, like, morality, and that there is a, even though there are these, like you were saying, there's all these bureaucratic Norwegian rules, there is a right and a wrong, you know, like the wolf killed this boy's sheep, so the wolf has to die, you know, like the mafia code in some ways, providing the upstanding moral code that this society is lacking. But sometimes that moral code is pretty whacked.
Right. It's a little conservative in that way.
Yeah.
Kind of being like, what are these ridiculous, you know, rules you made to protect this wolf? Like, that wolf deserves to die.
Yeah. Okay, my last question. One of the interesting things about Lilyhammer is that the whole show was put up at the same time, because this is premiering, at least in America, on Netflix. So they put up the entire season, all 8 episodes, on Netflix at the same time, thinking that, well, most people, when they watch TV shows on Netflix, and I'm certainly this way, they watch as much as they can, you know, they get into it and they just start marathoning everything. Do you think that was a good idea? Is that the right way to do it? When you're, as we're moving forward and quote-unquote TV shows start premiering on Netflix, is that the way to do it, or should they stagger it like a normal TV show would?
Well, I think that in the case of Netflix, you know, part of the reason we thought to start this show in the first place was that it can be difficult to find new things on Netflix.
Yeah.
Netflix does not have a great interface for pushing up new shows to highlight, or new movies to highlight. So I think that they actually did do a smart thing in that way, in that if they were to have to every week be like, a new episode is up, a new episode is up, there's actually not a good mechanism on the site for finding that.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
a great point.
That, like, I just noticed they resurfaced Futurama with new episodes, and that, you know, it took a while to find that. So I think that it was probably wise to be like, if you're interested in the show, here it is in its entirety.
Yeah.
Though apparently it's been renewed for season 2 already.
Oh, so we'll be able to watch more adventures of the man with one faces
exactly.
In the near future.
And the sneer. Lilyhammer is now available on Netflix Watch Instantly.
Okay, so now it's time to choose next week's main review. This is our listener's choice segment. We're going to give you 3 options for you guys to choose from, starting with the 1976 science fiction classic, The Man Who Fell to Earth, starring David Bowie, directed by Nicholas Roeg. This will be becoming available on Netflix starting on March 1st, I believe. Allison, you and I have never seen The Man Who Fell to Earth.
I'm so ashamed.
We're both deeply ashamed, but we're looking to correct that shame by making it one of the options for next week's listener's choice. If you guys pick that, we will be able to amend our shame, and we will discuss that on the next episode. What's option number 2?
Option number 2 is Southland Tales, Richard Kelly's 2006 follow-up to Donnie Darko. All 2 hours and 24 minutes of it. Highly divisive film, one I'm very fond of, one you're not as fond of, Matt. I think that might be putting it a little lightly.
I didn't hate it, and I've seen it since, and I have a sort of perverse affection for it.
Right,
so
that's a good way to put it.
That's one that we've both seen.
Yes.
But we wouldn't mind discussing again. It's
and
always
I wouldn't
fun.
Mind revisiting it.
Yeah. Yes. Now that it's no longer speculative science fiction, it's now past history. I guess it's worth a revision, or worth a revisitation anyway. So that's option 2.
Right. That's courtesy of Crackle, and it's also on YouTube for
okay.
free.
Great. And our 3rd option is another Netflix title, also becoming available on March 1st. This is a TV show as well, like Lilyhammer, but this is an actual TV show. It's a classic TV title. Another one that Allison and I haven't seen, and that's Miami Vice. Miami Vice, the classic TV show from the 1980s, produced by Michael Mann, of course, famously made into a big screen remake with Colin Farrell and Jamie Foxx. And
Say it.
I'm a fiend for mojitos. And the line, I'm a fiend for mojitos, of course. So we've seen the movie, but we really haven't seen much of the original show. Obviously, it's a multi-season series. We have sort of have lives, so we won't be able to watch the whole series. We won't be able to watch a whole season, but we're gonna, like we did this week, we'll try to watch a bunch of episodes as much as we can to dive into that. So, you know, people have always said it's one of the classic TV shows. I think it's worth watching to sort of compare, because this is one of those examples that was always like, this is good TV, but that was good TV in the 1980s. Now we've got, you know, Mad Men, Breaking Bad, The Sopranos, The Wire, all these things. I'm interested in comparing how it holds up next to some of those shows. So those are our 3 options.
All right. Well, which movie or TV show should we review on the next episode of Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit? Send your pick to feedback@filmspottingsvu.com or enter in the poll on the right-hand side of the page at filmspottingsvu.com. Your vote must be received by Monday, March 5th at noon. After that, we'll announce the winner on Twitter at our Twitter account, twitter.com/filmspottingsvu. And you'll have all that week to watch the film or TV show, and then join us for our conversation on next week's episode, which will be on Monday, March 12th. Now, if you watch The Man Who Fell to Earth or Southland Tales or Miami Vice and you want to join in the conversation, you can send us your feedback at feedback@filmspottingsvu.com.
FilmspottingSVU.com is also where you can find our show archive, as well as a list of direct links to all the movies we discuss on the show. The Filmspotting SVU remix theme song is by Vince Vandal. Listen to more of Vince's work at VinceVandal.com. We'll be back in 2 weeks with more movie recommendations and the movie review or TV review you pick. In the meantime, you can follow Allison and I on Twitter, twitter.com/AllisonWilmore and twitter.com/MattSinger. And once again, you can follow the show on Twitter, twitter.com/FilmspottingSVU. That's where we announce the winner of each week's listener's choice, and we've also taken to sharing more streaming suggestions from SVU listeners. For Film Spotting SVU, I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore. Thanks for listening.